Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty. Commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com.
Song I wrote, you might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry, be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry, be happy.
Look at me, I'm happy. Don't worry. Happy. Hey, I give you my phone number. When you worry, call me. I make you happy.
Don't worry. Be happy. Ain't got no cash, ain't got no style, ain't got no gal to make you smile. But don't worry. Be happy. Cause when you worry, your face will frown, and that will bring everybody down. So don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy.
Now there is this song I wrote. I hope you learned it note for note like good little children. Don't worry,
be happy.
Listen to what I say. In your life expect some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Be happy now.
Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, don't worry, don't do it. Be happy.
Put a smile on your face. Don't bring everybody down like this.
don't worry. It will soon pass, whatever it is. Don't worry, be happy. I'm not worried. I'm happy.
Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne on 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. The show is also rebroadcast on the third Monday and available as a podcast on our website, www.krfy.org. Just a little about myself. I spent the majority of my career as a pediatrician in a private practice in Columbus, Ohio, and as a media spokesperson for the National American Academy of Pediatrics, the Ohio chapter of the AAP, and the Central Ohio Pediatric Society. I loved educating my patients, their parents, and the public, in person, in print, and on radio and television. That's why this program is so important to me. I've been in Sandpoint since 2010, and truly appreciate our community radio station, KRFY. Another FYI, my current producer is my husband, John Broyens, the host of Jazz Over Sandpoint on Sunday at 8 p.m., and Tuesday at 9 p.m., also on 88.5 KRFY. That was Bobby McFerrin singing Don't Worry, Be Happy, because this is July and Social Wellness Month. And joining me in the studio to discuss this month's topic is Josh Barnes,
clinical social worker.
All of a sudden my brain just went boom. Licensed clinical social worker at Kiniksu Community Health. Josh, please introduce yourself to our listening audience.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Joanne. My name is Josh Barnes. I am, like you said, a licensed clinical social worker here in Sandpoint. I'm a Sandpoint native, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to be here with you today and talk a little bit about social wellness and mental health.
Okay. So again, we'll be doing social wellness and stress awareness because these subjects are so connected. The focus on stress awareness as a month began in 1992 by several mental health organizations to increase public awareness of the causes, effects, and management of stress. Furthermore, their objectives include breaking the stigma regarding mental health, encouraging stress management strategies which lead to healthier, more resilient lifestyles, and to encourage those who have concerns to seek help. So, Josh, let's delve into each topic a little further. Why do you think there's a stigma around mental health? Is it a lack of understanding, or is it something else?
Well, I think a lot of it kind of tracks the social trends that are going on. I think there's generally a stigma around health, you know, broadly, right? Everyone wants to be healthy or at least appear to be healthy.
And no one else know that you have something really wrong.
Right. But gratefully, in recent months and years, we've seen a large uptick in, you know, public awareness programs, different things that are really helping people to kind of step out into the light and treat mental health as more of an approachable subject.
So basically, our efforts or the efforts of the psychological societies are helping by promoting conversations and creating safe spaces to feel, share feelings. Having support groups. Are there support groups at Kiniksu to get people of the same sort of symptoms together?
Yeah, we have a few. Right now, a couple of the ones that are really, really going well is a DBT group, which is dialectical behavior therapy. Foundation of that is kind of mindfulness and emotional regulation strategies, things like that. And then we're actually launching a new group that's specifically around helping manage anxiety. So
the dialectical program is also in the schools. That is a combination or a coordination between Kiniksu and Lake Pontarie School District, or are there one separate two?
It has been a collaboration, yeah. I was doing a group over at Lake Ponderay High School this last year, and I believe that Bonner General Health is doing one at the high school, at Sandpoint High School as well.
So. Okay. It's difficult for the public to understand mental health diagnoses. I know even as a medical student, neuroses and psychoses were sort of scary words. We maybe don't even use them now as much today, but, you know, we knew basically when we got into school that neuroses were milder, somewhat easier to understand. They included depression or obsessive compulsive disorder or manic depressive, and now we recognize that more as bipolar. Is that correct?
Yes.
That manic. I had people who, you know, you went, are they in their manic phase?
Right.
You know,
right.
Because they were just really always doing something. Those diagnoses might have been a little bit milder, but easy to understand, but still very stressful on the person and the family, if that diagnosis does exist. And then psychoses were a break with reality. So that was harder to understand. How does someone really completely break with reality and have multiple personalities? And, you know, there are books that talked about multiple personalities. I always like to tell the story about there was a lady who had twins, and she would call a lot, but you didn't think there's anything specifically wrong with her. And one day in the hallway, she came up to me and went, Dr. Roynes, I'm fused. I was like, what? Because my medical partner had just broken her neck and was in a halo. So fusing to me was vertebrae. It wasn't personalities.
Right.
But, you know, it was just interesting that there, and I wouldn't have ever known that maybe that was why she called so much about, you know, what we thought were pretty trivial things, because that was the personality that she was into. But that's kind of a hard one to understand. If people have psychiatric diagnoses like that, do they get referred somewhere?
It really just depends on the severity of symptoms. I would say that we understand a lot more now about diagnoses like dissociative identity disorder, which used to be called kind of multiple personality disorder. And we see that more and more as a manifestation of usually early childhood trauma. And so it's pretty easy to understand. We all tend to dissociate from traumatic events in one way or another. Maybe we dissociate from our morning commute or other things that we have to do in life. But I like to tell clients and others that diagnosis is really a snapshot of where we're at in time, right? And so many of us have probably met the diagnostic criteria for many different things over the years, but maybe we don't now. And so I like to tell people that right off the bat, because it really helps people to understand that even if you have a diagnosis that may have one of these kind of stigmatic attachments to it, that there's all the hope in the world that things are going to improve over time, especially given the right interventions. So
that's a good way to look at it. We'll talk a little bit more about how we all have certain of these traits. There are so many different therapists now. How many different therapists, or can we go through the list? I was thinking about wellness coaches who have various different degrees, the licensed clinical social workers you are. The difference, is there a difference between that and the MSW, the medical social worker?
So the MSW would generally just be a master's in social work, and then each state has kind of their specific licensure requirements. The bulk of mental health services in the U.S., interestingly, are being performed by social workers and counselors, so the master's level counselors as well. And then there's also the marriage and family therapists. They're a little bit smaller of a group, but definitely contribute a lot to the field. So what we kind of have these days is if you're going to see a counselor therapist, you're probably going to be seeing a master's level clinician. And a lot of the psychological providers, the psych docs, are now doing mostly testing. Some of them still do clinical work as well. And then on the psychiatric field, you'd see mostly medication management with those folks.
Okay, so the psychiatrists being the medical doctors, psychotherapists, psychoanalysts, and people who prescribe medicine. I know that Dr. Wassaff at Kiniksu has an extra specialty in medication management, so that is a possibility too as a psychologist, a PsyD or a PhD.
Yeah, it's a really cool deal. He's one of the few in the state, I believe, that has that designation, and we're trying to expand that more and more to get those really qualified professionals able to prescribe as well. It's such a game changer to be able to have them in that role.
It's interesting, and that goes by state, because I think in Ohio you have to have the psychiatrist do the medication. And my daughter's a PsyD in Colorado, and I don't think she prescribes either. I think she has to refer to a psychiatrist. So
Yeah.
Your master's level counselors then are sort of the nurse practitioners or the, are there nurse practitioners and PAs with specialization in psychology too? Or
yeah, two of the providers that we have currently at Kinexu are psych NPs. And so usually they'll be kind of a service extender for the psych doc who's usually in the team. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, much like an NP or a nurse practitioner.
Okay. Well, that's great. It's a kind of a one-stop shop. And then you even work in conjunction with the schools. There are so many topics identified or discussed now as stressors. Stress impacts so many aspects of our life. It's interrelated to the psychological problems, such as anxiety and depression, but also to medical diagnoses like heart disease and decreased immune function and other medical disorders. We have stress at all different ages, and it changes as we age, from pediatrics to geriatrics. What are the most common stressors that bring clients to therapy?
Well, I think a lot of what we generally see is relational stressors, right? Things that are going on in families. Those have been, you know, around forever, obviously. Some of the things we're seeing more these days seem to be really focused around the access to technology. We can see a pretty direct correlation between youth anxiety levels and the introduction of the smartphone, the introduction of social media. And then, of course, right now, we see a lot of economically driven anxiety, particularly with young people, you know, as they're looking out toward the world and the likelihood of being able to purchase a home or just make ends meet. We see a lot of people really struggling with that economic reality right now.
I can see that. So school kids, the bullying, the feeling left out, but that can occur at any age. I remember, you know, again, a middle school experience when one of our children wanted to go to a football game and she called a friend and, you know, our car is full, you know, and just a little simple thing like that. It's not an act of bullying, but it's a being left out. And then, you know, you start to feel bad about yourself. Some people start feeling bad about themselves.
Sure.
You mentioned the technology. Jonathan Haidt, have you read that book, The Anxious Child?
I have, yeah.
You know, some people really, really are promoting it, and some people are saying he's, you know, being a little too dramatic about it. Certainly, the cell phone and the bullying and the who is, you know, sending your child a text, who is trying to contact your child, and they may not really know them. Those are the really scary things. Or then just using time with their friends and sure. Just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. So there can be bullying that way, and there can be bullying or scary kind of sexual implications to it too, which I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially if there's no kind of safeguards put on, you know, what kids can access and the time that they're spending. You can really think about it like, you know, when we were in school, we'd go home, we were away from whatever kind of bullying might have been occurring there, right? Well, now it can occur, you know, 24/7, right to the kid's bedroom. So there's really no escape from it if they're interfacing with that, you know, on a continual basis.
Do you suggest that parents, you know, have them turn off their phones at a certain time? Or I know there are restrictions on Facebook or Instagram for different accounts.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that it's a good idea to turn the phone off, you know, at least an hour or two before the desired bedtime. And then also to put some really good restrictions on the overall amount of time and certain apps. A lot of, you know, municipalities, even nations are now saying we probably don't want to have kids on social media apps until they're about 16 or older.
Yeah. And, you know, we all know that at 12 or something, you know, they're actually accessing social media. How do you handle your four kids?
That's a great question. we try our best to instill these kind of boundaries with them. They definitely push back, and that's a challenge that we see most people having. But the really important thing I think there is to just really focus on the long-term picture, right? And that's true of a lot of parenting, right? I mean, we're probably going to pay the price now as we get that pushback. But in the long term, we're going to see a lot healthier outcomes for these kids who aren't spending the bulk of their time on technology.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the anxiety publicity or commentaries have come after COVID, too, because kids were just so bored, I guess, and trying to find things to do. Now, there are, you know, good things on not social media, but the fact that they have a screen. And certainly the schools are giving out now iPads and computers, so they all have them. But so there is learning on it.
Yes. it's a gift and a curse, yes.
Do you have patients that come with sexual orientation questions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Sandpoint is becoming much more of a comfortable place for people to live and to live proudly in whatever identity they have. But there still is a lot of stigma around that. And what we see is, especially with young people, having a lot of anxiety about coming out, whatever that looks like for them, particularly if they don't have that core of kind of family and community support.
So does then the family or the school might suggest that they talk to somebody? Is that how it works?
Yeah, a lot of times it'll be family. It gets kind of tricky now with this new law that just started on July 1st, where we have a requirement now to reach out to parents and involve them in the process of talking about these things with any youth. Which I think comes from a really genuinely good idea of wanting to involve parents and caregivers in this process. And I think it will generally go fairly well. The one concern being, you know, in those situations where the parents are very non-supportive and where there may be even some difficult, you know, kind of pushback, let's say, if youth are exploring those topics. So it's kind of a delicate dance that we have to do, but definitely one worth doing.
Do the client and the parents ever have different counselors, or would you you recommend them having the same counselor?
Usually
if
different.
If they're willing to come.
Yeah, if they're willing, yeah. Usually different. You know, there are a lot of therapists who, you know, specialize in family therapy and do kind of family systems work and things like that. But generally, it'd be kind of a difficult conflict to have, let's say, a parent and a child as a client, and trying to honor both of their needs, you know, simultaneously, I think would be a difficult ask.
So it is better. And then, of course, there's, you talked about the budget or the financial concerns, being increasing anxiety and stress. And then, of course, choosing what you're going to do after high school, whether it be college or post-secondary options, and then the actual career.
Yeah.
So they're all different things that come up again throughout the life cycle. As we get older, we worry about, you know, the geriatric side worries about, you know, their lives and how they can support their families and how their families will eventually support them.
It all comes full circle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So child rearing in the 21st century is a little different, too, than it was, but not terribly. But anyway, so there's a lot of discussion about stress management strategies to achieve social wellness. What do you recommend to your clients how they can manage their stress?
Well, the biggest thing I try to recommend and try to practice, which is easier said than done, is just trying to slow down, right? And we live in such a fast-paced kind of on-demand culture. And so just being able to slow down, even for a few moments, can be really, really beneficial. That can often look like a number of things, but breathing is a very easy way to access that and to kind of bring the mental and the physiological kind of online with one another. So I recommend a lot of breathing, a lot of breath work. Also just asking the question, you know, what's my influence here? Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm worried about something, is there anything I can do about it? And if I can't do anything about it now or in the near future, trying as best we can to put that aside. And that really tends to, you know, leverage some bandwidth that we might be losing. Mm-hmm. If we're just pining over these things that are kind of existential, that are kind of out of our control, like things we see in the news, for example, is often a very large mm-hmm. source. We find ourselves recommending quite often, you know, turn the news off or at least diversify, you know, the news that we're consuming. To try to minimize that onslaught of fear that people are getting.
Yeah, because that's the first thing up on the screen.
Sure.
When you turn on your phone.
Or go to the airport or, yeah.
What about meditation and music or yoga?
Oh, yeah. Really all of the above. I mean, anything that we can access that we really, you know, feel comfortable with. And I'd say, you know, push through that discomfort a little bit too. I was incredibly resistant to things like yoga, meditation earlier in my life, and they've become, you know, just bedrock practices for me now. So, you know, you might surprise yourself. Maybe you don't see yourself as a yoga person or as a gym person, so to speak. But give it a shot. And that's really another one that we've seen. I mean, there's so much data now that's proving out this. You just have to be active a couple times a week. Mm-hmm. And that really, really is even more beneficial than often medication, psychotherapy, and the combination of both.
It's interesting because I wrote down a just quiet time for your brain. So that's kind of what you were talking about, too, as one of the ways that we can manage our stress. I would always tell my children as they were growing up, if they were very stressed, it was like, well, what I did when I, you know, was in practice, and I had four children also, it was like you just put one foot in front of the other and, you know, you go with it. So, Darren, you do have to have kind of a balance and a calendar. But you do it. Most people feel a little better if they fill in their time slots. But one of the time slots or several of the time spots can be just the quiet time.
Yeah, if you can schedule it in, even better, you know, whether it's the quiet time, time for reflection, time in nature. Interestingly, you know, we often, and I've certainly dealt with this myself, you feel like you don't have time to do these things, right? But what I've seen is if we can really kind of schedule them in and make them a priority, it really tends to add mm-hmm. to the day and kind of make everything else mm-hmm. go more smoothly. So you're really kind of at a net benefit there.
And you know what you're doing at what time. Limiting the stress triggers can also be setting boundaries and a work-life balance. We talked about managing screen time. And then, of course, learning to say no.
Yes, that's a hard one as well. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about sleep, but how do you achieve better sleep?
Well, scheduling is huge with that, right? And so we talk about sleep hygiene a lot. And probably the most important part about that goes back to technology again. I mean, people being on their phones probably right up to the moment of sleep often, right? They're on a game or watching something. Not a great promoter for sleeping. I often recommend that people, if they're on their phones, are reading text and not watching videos or things like that. Yeah. And so giving yourself a good hour or more before bed to kind of dedicate to that process of winding down, you know, kind of letting the cares of the day melt away as best we can. And then there's another really great protocol that Andrew Huberman, a doctor from Stanford, came out with called the non-sleep deep relaxation protocol. So that's on YouTube. And it's very simple. It's just a maximal inhale and then a really forced exhale, almost like you're exhaling through a straw. Do a few of those and your autonomic nervous system kicks in and you will relax.
I think I read about that and I mentioned that to people that I was talking to, like, was it the 7-second one? Is that was part of his or is that someone else's? It's pretty similar.
Yeah, it's quite similar. They all have their own little twist on them. And this one's kind of funny because the first time I did it, I was glad that I set a little timer because I just fell asleep in my office on my couch. And so, you know, I was able to wake back up in time for my next client, but it's very effective. And it's, you know, it says non-sleep, but it might put you to sleep.
Say that again.
The non-sleep deep relaxation protocol.
Okay.
There's a great YouTube video on it.
Remember that. Well, might mention that at the end, too. Yeah. So, again, and just educating yourself and others about the signs and symptoms of stress and mental health resources. One of the things when I was looking up the Stress Management Month was to, you know, have a group together and have a stress reduction challenge or something, you know, talking to your friends. But basically, practicing stress management strategies will promote a healthier lifestyle. So as stress is related not only to specific psychological diseases, but to diseases, as we mentioned, of diabetes and heart disease and decreasing your immune function, we could talk about these topics for several hours. But we're going to take just a little station break, or I'm just going to give you the station ID. You are listening to 88.5 KRFY, Pondere.
Thank you.
you turn us off? This is Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne, and that was Dave Brubeck with Unsquared Dance. You are listening to 88.5 KRFY. I'm here discussing stress awareness and social wellness this month with Josh Barnes, licensed clinical social worker at Kinnickzoo Community Health. Unfortunately, we all know that as our one of our entrance songs was that we can't just tell people to be happy and not to worry. We have to discuss those aspects of self-care that we just talked about. But we also know that some people come to therapy and we have to help them understand how we can separate normal stress and anxiety versus those that are pathological. I like to use examples such as, well, the person who can't get out of bed, or they can't get out of the house, or they can't go to school, or they can't go to work. And it often begins situational or truly medical, but becomes magnified the longer a person withdraws. Someone after injury or surgery gets deconditioned. Their muscles, they haven't used their muscles, so they have to get back on a schedule and use their muscles and have programs that are, well, that's physical therapy. They're sort of mental therapy, too, I guess. I would have patients with mono or other illnesses who needed their sleep, but then they went to bed so late and got up so late, and they needed to rest at home for a certain amount of days, but their sleep cycle got so disordered they can't resume their previous schedule at school or work. And the parents were really annoyed when I kind of said that, and it was like they thought there was something really medically wrong. It's mm-hmm. like, you've got to understand that I'm not, you know, poo-pooing or disregarding your concerns, but once your child doesn't get out of bed in the morning and you have to go to work and you leave him home again, then they're just learning that that's behavior that they can continue.
Right.
So what kind of clients come to you? Do you have those that kind of a patients that present with those concerns?
Yeah, we do have a few. I have a few currently that I do almost exclusively with telehealth, and I'm really grateful for that because a lot of these clients, you know, just would not be able to access in-person therapy that often. Mm. And so it's a big spectrum. I mean, we have all the way from, you know, the kind of generalized anxiety or maybe social driven anxiety that's, you know, kind of mild to moderate, to those folks that are, you know, almost completely in their home, fearful to go out in public, fearful to engage in what we would consider kind of normative daily activity. And so there's a lot of work there just trying to get those clients to build up those resiliency skills and things so that they can try those little steps to get out more. I have a client right now who's working on doing a little bit of part-time work just here and there, as he's trying to work his way back to full-time employment. And so lots of different challenges, lots of different examples of the ways that that can manifest in one's life. But I really think, like you said, the key is just in trying to destigmatize and find these people help so that they can get back to living healthy lives.
What do you think is the best way to encourage compliance?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, just focusing on what is the client's goal, right? You know, often clients are very aware that their life isn't where they want it to be. That's one of the main reasons why people come to therapy. And so we often kind of have to revert back to, okay, what was that? What was that long-term goal? Was that big picture? You know, what are we working toward? And I found that the clearer any of us can kind of define what we want in life, the easier it is to get there. And then when we run into those inevitable roadblocks and challenges, if we can refocus on, okay, what was my goal? What was my end goal there? We tend to be able to push through those a lot more effectively.
Are people more compliant if they self-refer or if they're referred by their parent or their school or their friend or their, you know, a family member?
I would say that generally self-referral is a much more compliant posture. However, we do see a lot of people who come in and, you know, mom and dad are kind of the driving force at the beginning. And over time, they really kind of buy in and kind of it becomes theirs.
It's interesting because I always think the most, you know, what are the most frustrating things that I had to deal with? And one is so simple as, you know, mom's really, 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 really concerned. And you call someone and, you know, fit them in early in someone's schedule. And then they have the visit and then they go, oh, I don't know. Well, they come back to us and you go, well, how'd that go? Well, the intake was really good, but he wanted me to come or she wanted me to come every set, you know, day of the week at, you know, this time. And I drive the soccer carpool then, or, you know, something like that. It's like, well, you were the one that was concerned and I got a friend to get you in sooner.
Right.
And now I don't say all those necessarily, but that would be what I'd be thinking, you know.
Yeah.
The fire would be coming out of my whatever. But so basically the patient, the client has to understand. Do you refer them to them as patients or clients?
Usually we refer to them as clients. You know, obviously broadly in the medical field, they're patients. But generally with counseling, we talk about them as clients. Okay. We do a lot of collaborative care, though, so it's kind of an interchangeable term around our office. We were working hand-in-hand with, you know, psych and with our main providers.
That primary care provider.
Yeah.
When a patient comes to you, some people just want a med to fix it, I guess, is what I was getting at. Is that difficult to deal with, or...?
Yeah, I mean, it's not as much of an issue for me or for us master's level clinicians. We don't have medication as part of our toolkit, which I'm kind of grateful for in a way because we get to focus on these other things like sleep, like exercise, diet, social life. And so I often tell clients, you know, let's focus on these things first. And if we can get your diet and your physical activity and your sleep and your social world all looking relatively healthy, and you're still struggling with a lot of anxiety or depression or other challenges, then let's go take a look at how medication might help.
Okay. And then you make the referral to your next level provider or you discuss them. We used to call them some of those curbside consults.
Yeah, and it's really great because more and more we're able to do this kind of holistic collaborative care where just the other day we had a client come into our same-day clinic. And we were gratefully able to get her in to see a counselor that same day, did a crisis visit, and then orient her toward further resources in the community and someone hopefully for medication management. So,
good. Then also you mentioned telehealth. So does that increase compliance? I assume it would because then the soccer carpool might not be quite as important.
Yeah. We have this great ability, especially since COVID, to do a lot more telehealth. I still very much, you know, prefer in-person counseling. Mm-hmm. I think most people do. But especially for those clients that live really far out of town or they have a large family or just other responsibilities and things that make it hard to come to the office. Or those clients, like I said, that just have kind of an aversion to the office atmosphere for whatever reason. It just really makes these things a lot more accessible to more people.
How do you get people to open up to you, to really talk?
It's really about building a relationship. We've found over the years that there are a lot of really effective techniques, a lot of theory. But even Carl Jung said, you know, at the end of the day, it's just one human soul touching another human soul. So that's really a big part of it, is building that rapport, building that trust with the client. And then inevitably over time, that relationship yields itself to a lot more disclosure and a lot more collaboration.
Do you usually see people once a week or?
Yeah, usually once a week. Yeah.
So there's an intake and then a continued visits.
Yeah.
What's your most common diagnosis? Or is there a common diagnosis?
I would say probably the most common one that we see is the generalized anxiety. And then also kind of major depressive disorder.
And the age over the years?
Younger and younger.
Your common age? Do you have a...
I personally see mostly teenagers 12 and older, and then adults. So... But we are seeing, we're actually seeing a little bit of a decrease in youth depression rates, but the youth anxiety rates are continuing to go up.
Okay, and that's, again, all the different stressors that we talked about, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
What about ADHD? There's obviously been a lot of publicity about that, too. We used to think of it as school-age children, and then now we talked about it in preschool, we talk about it for college students, and even a lot of publicity about adults.
Sure.
Which I think is pretty interesting. We probably all have some elements of that or OCD or something to get our work done, and how we get, you know, if you are doing a paper or you're doing some studying and you stand up and walk around for 5 minutes, whether that's ADD or that's just a good mental break,
sure.
You know, it's hard to say. It's, I guess the people with ADD wouldn't come back to it, and the people who don't would go back to whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that we could say about ADHD. I have ADHD. I wasn't diagnosed. I was diagnosed as a child. I wasn't medicated. And so what we're seeing now is, like you said, a lot of adults being diagnosed in adulthood and getting on medication for the first time, having a lot of success with that. But ADHD is a very misunderstood and stigmatized, just that phrase, you know, attention deficit disorder, right?
Yeah.
So what I often talk to people about with that is that it's kind of a misnomer, right? People with ADHD don't necessarily have a hard time focusing. As a matter of fact, if it's something we're interested in, we will hyper-focus.
You're over-focused.
Yeah. It's a superpower, right? It's really the switching between what we want to focus on and what we need to focus on demand is kind of that gap a lot of people have. So a medication can be incredibly helpful. It's not the only thing. The other thing that is really helpful is time outside with people you love, doing something you love as often as you can.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the biggest thing we've seen for a number of disorders, but particularly for ADHD.
Well, that's interesting. That goes back to the schedule. So does that work? Like we study for a half hour and then we go run around and...
It's incredibly important, yeah. Which, you know, like we were talking before the episode here, unfortunately, a lot of schools are getting away from recess. They're limiting that more and more, which is a step in the absolute wrong direction, not just for those with neurodivergency, but I think for all humans. We need to be outside. We need to be moving. And this expectation that we're going to sit in an office or a schoolroom for 8 hours a day is not very realistic.
That's interesting because the Ohio chapter of the AAP had a push for a while that they had prescription pads that doctors wrote, you know, time outside or something
sure.
like that. It was, you know, encouraging play. It's not play therapy by the definition of play therapy, but play, regular old-fashioned play,
yeah.
is therapy. So
well, and I love it at all ages, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we all need to play. And mm-hmm. sometimes as adults, we forget that that's a big part of our lives, too, or at least should be.
Mm-hmm. So if a child or an adult is worried about it, the evaluation, we always did questionnaires for the parents and the teachers because it had to be in two environments.
Sure.
You know, if your parent... you know, said the child was horrible and the teacher said the child was an angel, then, yeah. you know, there's kind of a parenting problem
sure.
or something going on in that the family relationship. Whereas if the teacher said the child was not doing well and the parents said they were just angels, then, you know, you look at a learning disability because they don't understand. If I'm speaking Greek and you don't understand Greek, you're not going to pay attention either. You're going to be, your mind's going to be wandering.
Yeah, that was me with math. Yeah.
Yes,
very much.
Interesting. So the children here or the adults can get tested. You said perhaps at Bonner, or where would the best place to be?
Yeah, so for full neuropsych testing, BGH has a clinician there, and then also Heritage Health in Coeur d'Alene is probably the closest. Unfortunately, it's kind of long-term, time limit people. There's a big wait list for the neuropsych, but with ADHD, we can generally diagnose that simply through the DSM-5 criteria, and then including that Columbia assessment. We often send it home with youth for their parents to do, and then at least one or two teachers
for the teachers
in those core subjects. And then with adults, it's a little bit more challenging to get that kind of coordination, but maybe a spouse or another loved one can kind of help fill in the gaps with that.
Would you go to your boss if you're being evaluated? I'm trying to decide if an adult would go to their boss and say, I need you to fill out this questionnaire. Perhaps their direct supervisor would be
that. Yeah, it could probably be quite helpful. And then that would really, certainly if you're seeing a level of disruption that your supervisors or coworkers are noticing, that would probably be a pretty good indicator that this is more than just your average attention issue.
So again, the attention issue versus the learning disabilities for schools, or even as people progress through college, I know that they can be diagnosed, or a high IQ and a low IQ. So there's all these different aspects, except that the attention, as you were talking about, the assessments that we as clinicians could get, we also diagnosed the attention deficit.
Yeah.
Problems by the questionnaires.
And that's one of the biggest misnomers, too, is that, I've worked with a lot of adults, particularly adult women, who were told things like, well, you can't have ADHD, you're a girl, right? Or, because for so long, and the original criteria for ADHD was developed for adolescent males,
there
right?
There were more, and there were, but of course, if that's what you're looking for, you end up with a biased group.
Of course. Yeah. And so for women, for especially adult women, this manifests in a lot of different ways. And it's not necessarily the fidgety, restless presentation that you would think of with ADHD. It's often coming through a little bit more in kind of more emotional kind of presentation. So
it's interesting as we get into other diagnoses, as I was thinking about it, there's a questionnaire now for every possible symptom at the office and online. So how do you do your intake and when a patient or client first comes to you?
Yeah, just collecting a lot of data, and really grateful for that approach to the work. It's person-centered, right? So it's like, what is going on? What are we feeling? What are we thinking? And what are our goals? And often in that first session, we can get a pretty clear picture of what clients are dealing with, especially if they're forthcoming with what's going on. And we always kind of administer the depression and anxiety scale just as a baseline. So that'll give us some pretty good data just as far as, well, how much anxiety are you feeling? And is there a source for that? Is there trauma involved that we can define? So there's a number of different things we tend to correlate there, but so much of it is on the client's own declared kind of statements of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So anxiety and depression are certainly common. Bipolar, do you see a lot of bipolar? Or
A little bit.
A certain number?
Generally, those folks are on more on the medication management side of things, and that seems to be a big line there, the functionality between someone who is properly medicated and not. And bipolar seems to be one of those diagnoses where folks tend to benefit a lot from medication, mm-hmm. Particularly in the minimization of that mania presentation. So,
when I was in practice, there were a lot of teenage girls with cutting. Is that still a common?
It is still a common thing. It has kind of ebbed and flowed, I would say. Interestingly, I will often, more often than not, if a youth is self-harming, their parents are aware of that. And they've already had conversations about that. And we could talk a lot about that topic as well. But self-harming is often not tied to any kind of suicidal ideation, right? Self-harming, in my experience, is often a unhealthy stress management technique that youth have developed or adults have developed. And so it's one that is often scary when it first presents, particularly mm-hmm. if you're a parent and mm-hmm. you find that your child is self-harming. It's a very, mm-hmm. very terrifying thing. And so what I recommend is, you know, just trying to get as many professionals involved as quickly as possible to assess, okay, is this about stress management or some other thing, or is this actually tied to a suicidal ideation?
Is it a call? So it's kind of a call for help.
Often it is. Yeah. Yeah.
But they cover up their arms.
Yes. There is certainly a lot of stigma around that as well.
Yeah. What about panic attacks?
Yeah. See quite a bit of that. Familiar with that myself as well. As a younger person, I had quite a bit of anxiety. And so a lot of these techniques and things that I teach are ones that I've had to develop myself and really practice. And that's really the key with so much of this stuff, Joanne, is, you know, maybe at first it doesn't feel very effective or maybe we're resistant to it. But as we practice it over and over again, it tends to become a lot more effective for us.
And I would say you're a success story.
I appreciate that.
PTSD, that's also had a lot of, you know, conversation recently. Do you find that, well, again, a lot of these things, I guess we were talking about, if you add anxiety or depression, it's a result of some trauma. It could be a trauma as a child, or it could be, you know, trauma as an adult, or it could be related to your service,
yeah.
you know, wars. And
yeah, and we really see two types of trauma broadly. We see kind of the what we call big T trauma, which is sort of what you'd expect, you know, car accidents, military, active duty, kind of combat stuff, life events that we could probably all squarely label traumatic, right? And then we have a much more insidious, kind of less appreciated form, which is kind of the chronic exposure to trauma. You'll often see that in kids that maybe grow up in a very disruptive environment. Maybe their parents are struggling with substance abuse or abusive in some way. We also see it a lot with survivors of domestic abuse and things like that. And so PTSD can show up really in anyone at any time. It's really just a matter of how much resilience does that person have as they are interfacing with a traumatic event. And so if you have other kind of risk factors, if you're already at kind of a pretty unstable place, something traumatic happens, it often has a very substantial effect on someone's life.
Do you ever do cognitive behavioral therapy? Because
yeah.
I know that's listed in a lot. And is there a short way to explain it? Because I've tried to read about it.
Yeah.
You know.
I think the easiest way to describe CBT is just challenge your thoughts, right? If you're having a thought, challenging, is it accurate? Is it healthy? Where's it coming from? You know, and often what we'll teach is this kind of cognitive reframing of, let's say the thought I'm having is I'm not good. I'm not good at this thing, or, I'm not good enough. Okay, well, how can we reframe that in a way that's more positive, right? I'm getting better at this thing. I'm growing. I'm developing. I'm learning, right? I'm better than I was last week or last year, right? So that's kind of the foundation of it, is really just challenging our own thoughts in real time as much as we can.
There's no manual that I found. Now, maybe I'm not looking at the right resources, but it's like, you know, you do this and you do that. But
yeah, it can be pretty intense as far as its application, but I'd say that's kind of the foundation of it. Then, of course, that really goes hand in hand with dialectical behavior therapy, which we also work a lot with. So,
okay, we're getting toward the end of our time. Do certain diagnoses benefit most from coming to see a clinician? Is it the age of the presentation or simply the person and how much they want to get help?
I think that's the biggest factor is how much is the individual client wanting to put into the therapeutic process? How much are they wanting to learn and grow? So that's why that self-referral is often so powerful, because if we're perceiving that there's an issue in our life that we want to change, that we want to make better, and we've got some buy-in to that process, the work generally goes pretty quickly and pretty smoothly. I really enjoy working with those kind of clients that come in and they've got a game plan, right? They know what they want. They've got some good goals outlined. And similarly, it's really fun to work with folks that maybe aren't quite sure. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, okay, let's try to dig down and find out what your core values are, what you really are trying to achieve in life, and let's do our best to get you there.
And you, Kinixu has some addiction program. I know we talked about that with alcoholism. Crisis management, you mentioned you do have an emergency or a same day. Just a little bit about that.
Yeah, Kinixu itself has a same day clinic. It's open from Monday through Thursday. And so that's a great option for our existing clients. They can go in there and get, you know, same day treatment. And like I said, that's been a great resource recently for us to be able to get clients that are struggling with different physical and mental issues help right away. And we're also always trying to expand services just regionally and at Kinixu specifically, to really try to get more of a holistic approach to this.
That's wonderful. The expansion over the years has been quite remarkable. So yeah. You're available in how many areas now?
We have counselors in our Sandpoint Clinic and then also in Bonners Ferry and Priest River. And then we also have clinicians that are full-time in the schools in both Boundary and Bonner County.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add? We're getting really close to the end, so.
Well, I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here today and to talk about these things. I would say that if anyone's struggling with any of the issues that we've talked about today, the encouragement would just be to reach out and talk to someone. There's no reason why we need to continue to have so much stigma around so many of these issues.
Okay. It is so important to talk to someone when you're worried about your feelings, and a little relaxation technique can go a long way.
It can.
All right. I think I'm going to practice that sleep technique. A sincere thank you to Josh Barnes, licensed clinical social worker at Kinixu Community Health, for providing excellent information as we feature July as Stress Awareness Month. And thank you for listening. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. If you missed any part of the program, you can catch the show at krfy.org under the podcast tab. I hope you'll join me on the first or third Monday of August for our next Medical Musing program. This is 88.5 KRFY Ponderay.